Obituary. June Mendoza. Britain's most prolific portrait painter died on May 15th, aged 99.
The moment she set eyes on him, June Mendoza knew he would be ideal. She was busy painting four presidents of the Royal Society of Engineering when his face appeared at the window. A nice face, plump and cheery, with brawny shoulders under a purple T-shirt. He was hard at work too, expertly fixing scaffolding with a twist of the tool that swung cheekily at his groin. When the engineers had left, she went to the window and asked if he would sit for her. He agreed at once. Her career as Britain's most called-on portrait painter was to encompass most of the grandees of the land. The list began with royals. Three Prince Philips, two Annes, three Charleses, two Dianas, five queens. She got very good at painting pearls. The queen's face, though, was not easy. Soft, rather than sharp. After these came archbishops, generals, prime ministers, eminent musicians, famous sports personalities, captains of industry, and entertainers. But generously mixed in with these, perhaps a third of her productions were her pickups. She spotted them across restaurants, at the theatre, in shops, and would boldly ask if she could paint them. All were surprised, but almost all went along with the novel experience of watching this small, slim woman darting back and forth from her unwieldy old easel, chatting. Her gift for catching likenesses was nothing she had learned. It was something you were born with, like perfect pitch. Her upbringing, with touring theatrical musicians in Australia, spurred her to watch performers and record them on paper. She would sit backstage with her drawing book, solitary but deeply happy. At school, she drew her classmates. At 12, she asked Sir Malcolm Sargent, then a doyen among conductors, whether she could draw him. He said yes. 2 years later, still in plaits and her school uniform, she went to life classes, naked men and all. It didn't bother her. In short, her childhood already revolved round portraits. Her professional sessions, though, often had to be done at breakneck speed, especially with the royals. So busy, poor dears. They might last merely an hour scattered over several weeks. On first meeting, she would set the rules, because no matter how grand her subject, here she was the boss. Even at Buckingham Palace, she was free to choose the chairs, the background, and the clothes, too, unless uniform was required. Fancy outfits on men or women were turned down. She wanted to do her subjects as they were, rather than pretending to be something else. At the start, most sat carefully. It was in breaks when they dropped the pose that she could think, "That's it," and pounce with her brush. Yet portraiture was not just about faces. Body language was almost more important. She needed to observe straight away the shape people made as they stood or sat, the tilt of their shoulders, how they held their heads. John Major's shape was a diagonal, Anne Widdecombe's a plump curve, Chris Evert's, off the court, a tall, thin rectangle. That gave her a frame for the rest. She once had to paint eight members of an academic committee who at first stood meekly in a row in their suits. When she asked them to sit, though, each sat differently. Together, they made the design she needed, delightfully irregular. After shape came colour, almost always oils for richness. She hated working from photographs, a gauze between her and her subjects. She wanted their energy and the paint to show. Around 17 colours made up her palette. One was flesh tone, used only as a base. When this baffled people, she asked them to look at the palms of their hands. They seemed pink, but she also saw Naples yellow, olive green, oranges and mauves. Some sitters, when she encouraged them to inspect the work in progress, were alarmed to find their noses blue. It would all make sense in time. Her formal artistic training had been spells at two art colleges, where she took nothing in. When she moved to London in her 20s, perching, like many Australians, in Earl's Court with a single gas ring and no bus fare, She used her paintings as barter, once for cough syrup, once for a fur coat. Her first paid job was drawing the Belle of the Ballet strip for Girl magazine for 5 years. But meanwhile, her reputation as a painter grew steadily. She worked like mad through bringing up 4 children to well into old age, driving miles from South London to wherever her subjects might be, lugging her easel up and down stairs, intrepid as ever. As she painted, she made many friends. The intimate situation encouraged chat, but there were also long, comfortable silences, the sort you would not get in ordinary socialising. Both she and the sitter were working hard then. The only person she could not connect with was Margaret Thatcher, who controlled herself so rigidly that she reported nothing there. A portrait emerged, but not one she was particularly pleased with. In fact, she was never totally happy with any of them. There was always a flaw. She was painfully aware that a beautiful painting could be a poor likeness and vice versa. A good likeness had to catch alertness, dynamism, life in short, and please the sitter. A good painting in colour and composition and technique had to satisfy and even move viewers who had no idea who the sitter was. That perfect balance was partly why she kept returning to the ordinary people who caught her eye. Perhaps, too, she was after the soul. No, that was much too pompous. She had enough tricky criteria to think about without that. What she undoubtedly glimpsed on the fly were great faces to draw. And thus her lovely scaffolder, Chris McCann, a tubular structural engineer, found himself hanging in a gallery in Girton College, Cambridge, radiating pride and affability from his high perch, all his own work. His portrait hung alongside those by other artists of a coracle maker, a fish delivery man, a vagrant, a milk tester, and a wheeler dealer. To June Mendoza, he might justifiably have hung beside the Queen.